So this is Rohatsu Sesshin. Rohatsu literally means eighth day of the 12th month. It is the day in which the Buddha's great awakening is commemorated. And so we, the teachers, thought it would be appropriate to choose a koan to have a look at that is about the Buddha's awakening. And so we are looking at the first case in the record of transmitting the light. This is the last of our koan collections that we study for our curriculum. It was written by Keizan Jokin, a Japanese Zen master. He offered stories of each of the of our Zen teachers in our lineage, of their enlightenment stories, to use as koans for us. And so the first one, of course, is Shakyamuni Buddha's story. And the case is, Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened. And he said, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. Just one sentence, so I'll read it again. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened, and he said, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. There is a fairly lengthy commentary, which I'm going to skip past, and then a verse. As there is for each of these koans in this collection. And I think delightfully, Keizan offers a little preamble to the verse. They all are more or less in the same vein. And so I will read you this one. This mountain monk would like to say a few humble words about this case. Would you like to listen? And then the verse. A splendid branch issues from the old plum tree. At the same time, obstructing thorns flourish everywhere. So, back to Shakyamuni's story. This one sentence, this grand awakening that sweeps up everything along with it. And when I read it, I can't help but wonder about the backstory. Nothing is offered. There's just this critical moment, and an exclamation. In one way, it's rather wonderful because if there's no known backstory, I mean, we know some. Who knows how much of it is true and how much isn't? But that allows us to fill in. Our own backstory allows us to step into it with our own lives as the narrative. I find myself doing this. If it were my story, so I think of when I was a child and trying to learn to ride a bike. The final statement and proclamation would be, Kate Hartland sat upon her bike at the top of the hill of Cherrytown Road and started zooming down and put her feet up on the handlebars and her hands up in the air and shouted with joy as she rolled to the bottom. However, the story before that was a long and difficult one. Of receiving this bike that I really didn't know what to do with. It was too big. And I was a scrawny, awkward child, not at all athletic, like my younger brother, who could already ride a bike. No problem for him. But for myself, this first time with high hopes, but not much capability, going out onto Cherrytown Road. And my dad there to help. And he held onto the bike while I got up onto it and sort of ran along next to me as I started to roll down that hill. And then let go And I immediately swerved off into the ditch and into the brambles, coming out humiliated and cut and bleeding, and repeating this multiple times until finally my father felt he could not really do much for me. I was on my own. And I put that bike into the basement in a dark corner and tried hard to forget about it. And several years went by during which I tried hard to forget about it. Everybody else belonged to the set of people who could ride bikes. But I was trying to make my peace as one of those who would never be able to. I was just not that person. And then one day, feeling that weight of disappointment and humiliation, I was in the basement and there was that bike. Impossible to completely hide it. And so I pulled it out and thought, I'm going to figure this out. And there in the basement, where I could make maybe 1.5 rotations of the pedal, getting up on the bike and moving it forward and trying, and then taking it out on the road and finding out that I could fly down the hill. How did that happen? What was the transition? What made the difference? No idea. But all of that effort and the failing and the terrible feelings that went along with it, disappointing my father and myself and wanting to hide it all away, all of that was utterly necessary for me to be able to fly down the hill with my feet on the handlebars and my hands up in the air. And so we know enough about Shakyamuni's backstory, and we certainly know enough about our own to recognize that probably there's a lot of difficulty that comes before this point of being able to proclaim for ourselves with no doubts whatsoever, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. And notice that there are no qualifiers in here. It doesn't say, I and all beings on our better days simultaneously achieve. Everything is gathered in. All of the heartache and the disappointment and the hard work and the failing. All intimately a part of it. I was looking at a different translation in which it went more like this. I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember exactly. I and the great earth and beings simultaneously did achieve, are achieving, and will achieve the way. So not only all form, all beings, all everything, but in all times achieving the way, right now. Nothing left out. And how could it be this moment, the result of endless, beginningless, infinite actions, causes, and effects, all of them coming to fruition and unfolding in this moment, and setting the stage for all that is to come forevermore. Nothing left out. We can't possibly speak of anything without including all. And this, I and the great earth and beings. If we're not careful, we might think that there's a division there. An I and an and. And in his commentary, Keizan cautions us not to fall into that trap. Who is this I who awakens simultaneously with all beings? Who are these beings who awaken simultaneously with I? This is a matter that we must clarify for ourselves so that we can throw our hands up in the air and fly down the hill. who is the I? And what changed at that moment of seeing the morning star? What changed going down in the basement years later and deciding to ride that bike and finding that it was possible? Don't know. Don't know what the shift was. Things happen underground. They happen out of our sight, but they happen if we make the effort. Never forgetting that bike in the corner. Never really turning away from this great aspiration that we feel, this longing to know what it is that the Buddha was proclaiming, to know it for ourselves. We grope about in the dark for the way to do this, and that's appropriate, just to grope. And in the dark, things happen. We don't need to know what, we just have to participate, to bring our full selves into it. And with some faith, as Mike mentioned last night, some faith that all things will meet us in that effort. Who is being met? Who is meeting? What is different about what has been gained in that moment of proclamation that was not there before, or what is lost that was there before? What is the shift? Hopefully, Mike will let us know.
Well, on the bright side, Buddha has done all the work for us. Buddha realized that all beings have attained the way, all beings of past, present, and future, and that includes us. So we've already done it. We're included in Buddha's realization. So in some important sense, nothing to be done. Congratulations. Rahatsu, celebrating our true nature. And, of course, sometimes we have moments where it resonates and all makes sense, and there are other moments where none of it makes sense. The thorns do crop up. We reach for the flower of awakening and get pricked, and end up receiving a dash to our ego. Some sense that we are not awake, that we are not what we think we should be. We fall off the bike. We land in the brambles. We get our cuts and bruises. And we're encouraged to realize that these falls are also it. That the thorn pricking us is also awakening. And it is, isn't it? It's quite a thing to reach in and get stuck by a thorn. Boom! Awake! Sharp, piercing, awakening. Like the bell in the morning. Like the Han calling us to practice. So nothing, really nothing, need be excluded. Even the feeling that this is not it is, of course, it. Great faith that contains all of this. It's an incredible thing that some 2,600 years ago, Buddha had such a profound experience. And I think it is important to recall the story of the night before, as Kate was pointing to, and of the years before, of what it was like sitting under the Bodhi tree, so we are told, and to have Mara show up and tempt the Buddha with desires, fear, fear of death, arrows flying. And Buddha's practice is our practice. To sit and look and pay attention and see those arrows coming at us. And still we stay on the cushion and just look. I see you, Mara. I see these arrows. And we are told they transform into flowers. What are those flowers? Perhaps they are tears. Tears of agony running down our faces. Perhaps laughter, who knows? The arrows and flowers are not separate, not two. Buddha and the world are not separate. I, together with all beings, have attained the way. Everything included. The separate self constituted of all beings. I love a passage, Thich Nhat Hanh writes, the self is made of non-self elements. So everything is folded into us, and we are folded into everything. Lest we think solipsistically. A kind of unity that is just true, despite whether we know it or believe it or feel it to be true, that we are so profoundly interwoven, that our tears are ocean water. No gap at all. We have intimations of this all the time in the chirping or crowing of a bird, in the traffic passing by, in our breathing. The pain of our knees, this entire landscape, inseparable. And of course, as we read, the moment a mental formation arises, so do the thousand things. The thousand waves, and still one ocean. Still one vast presence that we are seeing as separate in many, many different ways. We're told that out of seeing all this separateness, suffering can arise. Right and wrong, good, bad, certainty. Knowing that I am right until I see that I am wrong. And all the pain that that can entail. Yes, well, this too is us riding the bike, sometimes through the brambles, getting pricked by thorns, all of it, the content of awakening. Nothing need be excluded. All being. That's the part that's sort of hard to fathom. The mind says some things are awakening and some things are not. But this great faith of entrusting that all things are included. It's hard to realize this as we are truly falling into the ditch. Hard to practice in those moments. Hard to bear those moments. And this is our courage. This is our practice. Why we're here supporting each other. Otherwise, perhaps every one of us would have turned and run a long time ago. So we rely on each other. And each of us doing our best to play our part. So that others can rely on us. Each of us falling off the path, relying on one another, turning again toward what is, bowing down to what is, at first perhaps resentfully, perhaps submitting, And at other times, perhaps gratefully bowing down, just bowing down to what is. It's a remarkable thing that somehow this experience for Buddha, after so much looking, seems to have changed the direction of his life. And yet, you know, I imagine that having awakened, still, Buddha stepped on thorns. We read the story of how Buddha once stepped on a thorn afterward and said with many, many, many adjectives how much it sucked. And in that moment, the content of Buddha's awakening is, ow, 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 that sucks. Oh, I don't like this. This too. And those moments of joy, those precious moments of unity, sense of those formations falling away, oneness. Yes, this too. All of it our practice. It's an incredible thing all these years later to celebrate this moment of Buddha's life. To both recognize that it really must have been transformative. That in some way there is that true possibility for all of us to realize the way that has already been realized. And at the same time to realize that it may not change the content of our experience at all. That there will still be thorns. And that our commitment is to continue practicing being awake to those sensations, to the aliveness.
So this is the part where you all get to speak up and offer your comments, questions, whatever you want to bring forward.
What?
So Kate told us these lovely before and after stories. Before the morning star, after the morning star. Before childhood Kate could roll down the hill without falling, after childhood Kate could roll down the hill without falling. And then earlier in the Sutta service, Dogen was insisting to us that there is no before and after, and that there's never a time when your Buddha nature is not fully actualized. So how do we reconcile, you know, these before and after, before the twirling flower, after the twirling flower stories with this insistence by Dogen that practice and enlightenment were always one thing, and there was no before and nothing that could come after, or should we not reconcile it?
Mm. That's the question, isn't it? Yeah. Who is it that wants to reconcile it? Who is it that insists that there be the one recognizable way of things? Right? So maybe the problem is in the question itself.
And you're pointing out, you know, the way our minds work, the way your mind works, the way my mind works, we love to make up stories that go through time from past to present to future. And that's just human being ordinariness, and that's a version of the awakened heart right there. And then it's just not the whole thing. And you know that yourself, right? There are also these times, Dogen says, where past moves to present, but future also moves to present. There's just this, and it reverberates through the entire universe, and there's never been a narrative, never been a story, It's just this, just this, just this, constantly. And sometimes we're in that place. You know, he also talks about it's like being on a boat and looking at the shore. You know, everything looks round because of where we happen to be. And fish see that whole experience differently. It's like a palace. It's like a jewel. So this is this constantly shifting view. We have to learn to shift with it. And sometimes I didn't know how to ride a bike and then I did. And sometimes, bike! No problem.
Carol?
The bike story, I really enjoyed that. And what struck me in it was the parent trying so hard to help the child ride the bike, and the love of the parent. And in the end, the discovery has to be made by that being herself. The awareness that maybe Alan was talking about has to emerge to know that the bike can be ridden by this being. So the parent, and I feel I do this all the time with my children and students, and I want to help them do it. I want to make sure they don't fall off that bike, they don't get stuck by the brambles. But then they never will ride the bike.
I was just going to say, it reminds me of when I first started teaching people to throw pots on the potter's wheel. It's such a long process, and I realized the hardest thing was my frustration. If I got frustration, I could tell, put your hand here, do this and that. And then when I learned to hold it a little larger and to trust, for me to trust in the student's capacity, and I think for all of us, with our friends, with our family, how do we, one, bear our own impatience, and then really have faith in this capacity, even when the student may not have faith in their capacity. Part of our job is, oh, of course you know how to do this. And I just know you're going to find just the right way for you to learn it. Yeah.
Still.
So, when you stick your hand into a thorn bush and you pull it out and see the blood and the pain, that's awakening. But when you say, "Bill, you stupid clod, why did you do that?" does it stop being awakening, or is that also awakening? It's all awakening.
Well, that's a stupid question.
I really trusted that you'd answer it, though.
Paul?
I appreciate the bike image, and I like that others are jumping on it as well. My wife owns a great bike, really a very good bike. And we used to ride as far as this bike. But she hasn't ridden it for about 10 years. And we made the decision earlier this year that, I should say earlier this term, a couple of months ago, that her bike riding days were over. And I say we because I was there with her. It wasn't my decision to make, but it was my it was mine to watch. It was mine to witness. That's there. And so there seems to be, nothing's missing about the bike story. And there's, not capable of riding the bike. Riding the bike. Not capable of riding the bike anymore. And this bike is going to go to a 10-year-old girl for Christmas. And she's going to learn to love it, to forget it, and all of the above.
Yeah, I this, you know, this feeling of failure, the actuality of failure of the body, of the mind, of our intellect, of our memory, is part of the deal. And it's funny because for me, there one way of talking about this is faith, is the sense that, you know, reaching into the thorn bush and coming out bloody, even though I am absolutely positive that that's not it, is it. And so there's some kind of everything being included, you know, no bike at all is included.
I really like this imagery of the thorn bush. There was a time before I sliced my thumb in the kitchen, and a time after my thumb in the kitchen this morning. And I realized that as mindful as I was trying to be about slicing the apples, I was quite aware when I cut my thumb and realized in that moment, ow, I think I just cut my thumb. And watching those feelings arise of like, oh, you idiot, you should be cutting these apples and paying attention, and you were paying attention, weren't you? And look at what happened. You know, you're trying to pay attention and do a great job, and you still end up like slicing your thumb. So I just really appreciate that image of, you know, regardless of how hard or good we think we're working, you know, that things happen, and sometimes you slice your thumb and that's it, and you get a Band-Aid, and that's it too. So
That's one of the wonderful things about that verse at the end, you know, that we want it all to be plum blossoms. Oh, it's plum blossoms. All right, I made it. And we don't want the thorns. But Kesam's very clear, right? And all his verses are a bit like this. He names both sides of things. He tends to do that because he must have cut his thumb slicing apples himself, right? And more than that, he must have lived a human life where Zen is human life embedded in Zen, I guess is what I want to say, and so there's no avoiding difficulties and pain and sorrow, and there are plum blossoms, right? And this capacity to keep shifting view until it all kind of coalesces into no view, just ow and ooh pretty.
Steve?
These moments. So David was talking about throwing pots, and I don't throw clay, but I do make stained glass. And part of what you do when you make stained glass is you have to melt lead. Okay, and the lead solders all of the pieces together, so it becomes a cohesive piece. And I always fuck that up. Always. So there is the repair of the you know, first attempt, and then there's the repair of the first repair, and so there's this. Sort of constant inching towards something, whatever that thing is, okay? And my problem is, it's kind of like taking the half step towards the wall, and then you take half of the next half, and so. So it's like at some point, when do we really reach what we seek? You know what I mean? So, there's a trick to it, and some.
What is it? What is it?
What is it? So you can go to see my little piece that's in the kitchen right now, and just see how far I got before I said, this is it. I'm done with this.
Well, and I think, isn't that how it is in our practice? We're at some point, and that's what the Buddha said, this is it.
This is it.
And we have to be done with something to realize this is it. You know, I think why we have to try so hard. We try so hard to avoid the thorns. We try so hard to find our way. I'm going to get enlightenment. This session, I'm going to stay up late. You know, I'm really going to get it, right? I'm going to solder it perfectly. And then sometimes there is this dawning realization that all the time, you know, each mistake has been perfect. That there isn't something outside. There is no outside to look back on. Everything included. And I love the, I give up. I give up. This is it. Oh, this is it. Mm. Yeah.
And I keep thinking about, through all these stories and examples, which I appreciate so much, years ago, speaking to a South African musician who played the mbira, the thumb piano, and you know it's a pattern of notes. And when you make a mistake in the pattern, that's the new pattern. You have to be so present that you catch it, and then you go and you play that for a whole bunch of times, and then you inevitably make another mistake, and that's the new pattern. And if you ever listen to recordings of South African mbira music, you can, it sounds like they're doing it on purpose. But what this guy said is, nope. if it was perfect, it would just be the same pattern for, you know, 20 minutes. But it isn't. And to me, that's how life actually unfolds. You know, the I give up becomes its own new pattern of maybe being present with things as they are. And then the next thing happens, and then the next thing happens. And if we keep rushing back to say, oh, if only I, oh, why didn't I made it, oh, all these mistakes, then that's the new pattern. You know, you see, like, it's all good. And it's, there's no good. It's just is. It just is.
Carol?
What I'm going to say now has sort of been said many times now, but it's still very much on my mind. I kept thinking, as you were talking about, the, I guess it's both Rumi and Leonard Cohen talk about the stronger at the broken spots, which is a bit of a cliche, but I think cliches are cliches because they're so real. You know, you've said it so many times. But I had a slightly new experience of it this morning, looking at the postcard or something above the table where all the spices are.
Thinking.
And it's a picture of a bowl, and it says that the Japanese treasure the parts when it breaks, and they fill them in with gold to emphasize that it's an essential part of the history of this bowl. Hmm. The bowl wouldn't be what it is without that. And I just love the image of the gold highlighting it. Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yet there's something, there is a painful quality when we feel that we've broken, right? That there's something broken. And to sort of push that aside and say, oh no, that's the beautiful part. When we don't feel that it's the beautiful part, right?
A very long time in between.
Yeah, and to wonder about what it is that gets in the way of seeing that. What expectations, how we box ourselves in to this idea of how it has to be, doing it to ourselves.
Well, and going with what you were saying before, Kate, that how it transforms by itself, that this is not a practice of positive thinking. Oh, it's good I'm broken, it's good I'm broken. But rather being in the brokenness, being in the despair, and I think the trick, here's the trick, I think, Steve, is staying long enough, staying where we are long enough to see, to be transformed, not to, all right, I know what I need to do with this, but this much more, I don't know, I cannot do this. And yet, if we sit long enough, even sit for 25 minutes, something happens that is just mysterious. And then we see that picture.
Yeah.
I really like all the sort of affirmation of giving up and being with what is, but also a lump of clay isn't a bowl. And if you let the lump of clay sit there, it's never going to be a bowl. And if you need a bowl, then that's not enough to just be with what is.
Well, though, I would say part of what is I want a bowl. I want a bowl. Like, what is it that you want? And then attack that clay. You know, turn the wheel on. It doesn't matter whether you're doing it right. But I think you're pointing to this intention and this bodhicitta, this way-seeking heart that... And it is both. We can get lost in, well, it's just the way it is. But this Buddha, quite determined to wake up. And I was reading that in sort of a joke in some monasteries that Buddha is still sitting in Tushita heaven, still doing his zazen, hoping to wake up. Right? So I think you're right. If we don't do something, if we don't start making mistakes... then we miss it. Because part of what is this great longing for liberation to be right here. Yeah, so thanks for bringing that in.
And I want a bowl, and is there an idea of what the bowl must look like, right? And then we fail to get it to look like that, missing it again and again as we see it. But really, we've made all these beautiful vases.
Or plates.
Yeah, right?
We're a little abstract. But, you know, and this is a hard thing to get the mind around, that every step along the way is it, right? Including the wanting, including the, you know, the comparing mind, including the ow when you cut your finger, that if everything is it, and then we just kind of collapse in that. Well, the collapsing is it, too. There's no way out of this metaphor. there is something that happens that where we realize we're on the path. And I'm saying that that's not a complete metaphor, because we could take that apart too. But there is some way that there's a ka-chunk that happens. It's like everyone here has been on sesshin before. This is the first sesshin that I remember teaching where that's true. Mm-hmm. There's nobody trying it out for the first time. Everybody here has had the experience of pain and failure and joy and seeing flowers and hearing the airplane go by and going, oh my God, everything is so wonderful, and then, you know, collapsing and being exhausted. I don't have to go on, right? And yet we all came back, because we know that this being here has something in it that's a really good fit for us, for each one of us, to find ourselves on the path. And that, so you can see that any place you look, it's an incomplete view, but it's also the whole view, wherever the view is. And this is a place where we get to practice a time-honored version of putting the clay on the wheel. We don't know what our bowls are going to look like. And ashtrays are useful in some
Yes.
So this is my third retreat, and I'm sitting here as I normally do things, going, I need to get everything right. I need to pay attention to what I'm doing, do everything right, make sure my order is correct, and all this. And during one of the Kinhin market, hit the clappers to speed up. And I'm thinking, why is Jamie going the wrong way? And I came back to my seat, and I'm like, oh, crap. I went the wrong way. And as soon as I realized, as if to punctuate my self-embarrassment, Paul says, remember keeping, you know, continuing in Team Hand, like, yeah, and then I realize that all these people can cram. And so, basically from this point to around just past the kitchen, every step was stupid. And then I finally managed to sort of, okay, no, it's okay, and I swallowed my burning pride, and like, now I can make mistakes too. And then I realize now that I'm sitting here again, I still refuse to sit with my feet in front of me, which isn't even a rule here, it's a Japanese rule. And I won't do that, and I'm still adjusting my Christian issues, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm back to who I was. Trying to be perfect again, and just kind of laugh at myself. And, yeah, that's just me.
That was a wonderful experience for me being behind you, because I realized I'm not the only one who screws up. Thank you.
Well, you know, and you know, this—we don't have forms in Zen to practice being perfect. We have forms in Zen to so that we smash up against them and screw up all the time. And if you're paying attention to what's going on up here with the four of us, like during Orioki, there's elbowing going on. Get up! No! Because it's impossible to follow all these forms. It's actually impossible. So it's kind of a wonderful atmosphere of, Dogen says in a wonderful passage, you take a step forward, mistake. You take a step backward, mistake. Take a step to the right, mistake. Take a step to the left, mistake. You stay still, mistake. And then he says, it's one continuous mistake.